Hey folks, it's Jeff Fuzzy Wenzel from the Woodshed Agency, and you are listening to a new episode of Successfully Funded. Here we go, let's turn it up. Hey everybody, how is everybody doing out there in the land of crowdfunding? I am Jeff Fuzzy Wenzel, your host of Successfully Funded, and today we are going to be talking equity crowdfunding. Yeah, we haven't done that in a little while. It's probably been almost a year since we've had a campaign on. But today is an exciting episode, right? Exciting episode, because we're going to be talking to one of the founders of this WeFunder campaign right now for the restaurant Gage and Tolner, which is an oyster and chop house that's very, very famous over in Brooklyn, New York. And we're going to be talking about what they're doing in terms of raising money right now on WeFunder. So Sinjin and I got on a call and, you know, just kind of broke down what it's going to take to revive this restaurant. This restaurant's got a great 100-year-old story. It was very, very famous at some point. Then it closed and eventually became an Arby's. And I'm saying too much. We'll get into all that coming up here on today's episode, so stay tuned for that. But what else is going on around here? Well, it's football season. It is in the air. I was up last night a little late watching the Green Bay Packers and Chicago Bears. And if you're a football fan, that was pretty amazing last night. Pretty amazing, I got to say. But, you know, here in Detroit, we've got one of those days where it is fall, man. It is like, you know, high 50s, rainy, dark and gloomy. So, but first week of the kids going to school. Yeah, kids are gone. It's 9:50. There's no distractions here. I mean, listen, I know this is not good for audio, but listen. You hear that? That's nothing. Typically, there's like a pterodactyl or something running behind me as I'm doing this or sending emails. Or if there is quiet, that means I've literally, you know, yelled at my kids to the point where I told them that they have to shut up, watch TV, go in the other room, right? You know. Basically just being a really great dad in a nutshell. But yeah, so with football back, I am in that torn stage. Football has really got a sour taste in my mouth in terms of the politicalness of it, the overexposure of it, the too many games, the amount of money, the commercials, the injuries, the concussions. But my son is loving it, and we bonded all morning today as we watched some highlights, and he's going through his, like, books, and he's picking out, oh my gosh, look at that guy, who is that, you know, and he's naming off people, which I find amazing. Like, yesterday, like, the Vikings played, the Minnesota Vikings, and he's talking about their safety, Harrison Smith, as if, you know, why do you know Harrison Smith? Why do you know the safety on the Vikings? And he may be good. But yeah, my son's just like, oh yeah, he's one of my favorite guys. When I'm like, what? You know, it's crazy to see how big of a machine the NFL marketing is to the point where it's embedding itself into a 7-year-old brain of like players and names, and he's knowing trades. And I can just go back and see like how it infused my life, where I was baseball cards and football cards and trying to collect them all. And my son's doing the same thing with these sticker things. He's going through his book and he's looking at what draft pick. And it's fascinating. It really is fascinating. But then I'm torn because, boy, I don't know if football is going to be. Well, actually, football will be around if it's doing what it's doing right now, because my son's going to play it. He's not going to even think about injuries. It's just, that's a battle. That's going to be a battle here because, you know, I know my son loves it. I love football, but it's a dangerous sport. Flat out, it is a dangerous sport. So we got that going on around here. Got that going on. But other thing is, man, we're just so kind of in the this new era. That I was reading in my Dollar Shave Club that they send you this they send you like this pamphlet, and I was reading through that about how, you know, the month of September for a lot of people, for everybody, feels like, you know, it's almost like the really the New Year's resolutions. This is actually where I feel like we're supposed to be shedding our old skins and doing stuff new and dreaming about the future. And that's exactly what the energy is around here. And in this article I was reading, you know, that it is something. It is a trait that a lot of people have because of back to school, because, you know, we have generations of ingrained that like August, September, fall starts to, you know, it kicks in this like something new is happening, new school. You know, and when you get, you know, a couple of years, or, you know, get 12, 13 years of that ingrained into you, it just happens year after year. So I'm right in that point right now where it just feels like all this could be happening. We've got a ton of leads. I got calls all day after this to get some stuff closed. And we're just kind of planning out this, you know, these last quarters of the year, basically, right? The, you know, the third and fourth quarter, we're going to start planning this stuff out. And boy, it's crazy how much September feels, really feels like the new, right? Like New Year's resolutions, I don't even think about those. Those come and go. But September, that's a whole different thing, a whole different ball of wax here. So hopefully all of you guys out there are feeling that same sort of way and feeling that sort of energy. And I'm wishing all of you guys a ton of success, especially if you guys are running crowdfunding campaigns. Like hopefully you guys can go out and get it. So, but yeah, so conversation. Let's talk about this again here. So we're talking to St. Jen, and we're going to talk about Gage and Tolner. What it takes to do equity crowdfunding for a restaurant, which if you know anything about me and you've ever talked to me or listened to some of these episodes, if you are thinking about franchising a restaurant, starting a brewery, a bar, whatever it might be, man, you got to look at equity crowdfunding. It is where it's at. So this campaign does need a little bit of help. They currently have a minimum of $400,000, and they're about half, a little over half of it. So they've got some work to do. But they've got a lot of time still ahead of them. And, hopefully if you guys are out there listening and you're thinking about maybe being a part owner of a restaurant, go invest, go over to WeFunder right now and check out Gage and Tolner. So, all right, let's go ahead and kick my conversation. And, yeah, here we go. Let's go. Let's do it. All right, Sinjin, so the red light's on. We are recording, so I hope you're not nervous or anything like that. I hope you're feeling all right.
No, I feel great.
Awesome. Cool. Well, let's start off doing a quick sound check. So why don't you tell my listeners what you had for breakfast this morning?
Let's see. I had a breakfast sandwich that my girlfriend got me from Court Street Grocers. It was on a nice little bun, some arugula, some scrambled eggs. Good stuff.
That sounds tasty. Nice. You go there often, or was it first time there, or was that a special, like, hey, I want that sandwich. I know that's a good one.
She was headed that way anyway, and I said, hey, while you're over there, why don't you pick up one of those nice breakfast sandwiches for me?
Very cool. All right, well, I think we're sounding good here, so we can go ahead and jump right in. So we're talking today because you guys are running a WeFunder campaign. So why don't you tell my listeners what you're currently raising money for over on that platform?
Yeah, so me and my two partners, Ben and Sohi, are reopening a 140-year-old chop house in the heart of downtown Brooklyn called Gage and Tolner. Yeah.
Very cool. That's very, very cool. So, you know, what makes this special? What's going on with this restaurant?
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, it was a going concern and pretty famous for 125 years, from 1879 until 2004. At that point, Brooklyn was the you know, the culinary renaissance for which Brooklyn is known now was just in its beginning phase. And old-fashioned restaurants like Gage and Tolner were definitely not the style. So it closed, and it was also in a neighborhood that was untouched by the gentrification and the explosion of creativity that was happening all over the borough.
Sure.
Because it was right in the middle of town, and it's right by, you know, the courthouses and the borough hall, and it's a very busy neighborhood, but not, doesn't have a reputation as being cutting edge. Hmm. You know. Gage and Tolner closed It was landmarked, though, in the 1970s. So the interior has legal protection and can't be changed very easily. So when you walk in now, the interior looks, you know, much the same as it did when you walked in 125 years ago.
That's really sweet. That's really sweet. So
yeah,
you know, when you were kind of mentioning like what is an older fashion style restaurant, like what does that mean in terms of like the cuisine and the atmosphere and all that sort of stuff?
Well, we have menus from this place going back to 1919 is the oldest one that we have. And the menus, and we have them, you know, going through the years, and the menus really didn't change all that much from 1919 to I'd say like the 1980s. Like everything is a la carte. There are 16 preparations for oysters, 16 preparations for clams, and you really got to order sort of exactly what you wanted. There were no plates sort of made up for you, and there was an oyster and chop house, which meant, you know, as opposed to a restaurant. And a restaurant, I think, was a little more continental, a little fancier, had more European influences, where the food here was always known as being very straightforward. But it was always known for its warm hospitality.
Hmm. Interesting. So, you know, so you mentioned that it closed. When did it close? 2000, what was it?
2004.
2004.
Yeah, 2004.
Well, I was
saying, at that point, it closed it in 2004, and it became a TGI Fridays.
Oh, wonderful!
Which was open. Yeah, that was open for a year, and just to show you sort of the progression of it. So it was this, you know, legendary chop house. It was its heyday was probably, I want to say, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That's when it was really humming. And it was noted in national magazines. You know, a Truman Capote wrote an essay about it. It was very well known. And then, in the 80s and 90s, I think they got less and less business. And then in 2004, it closed. It became a TGI Fridays. After that, it closed and became an Arby's. It was an Arby's for 3 years. And to understand how bizarre it is. I mean, this place, like, the interior is landmarked for a reason. It's absolutely beautiful. You have these rows of arched mirrors going down the length of the room. The mirrors are framed with, you know, panels of cut velvet and beautiful rosewood woodwork. The signature in the room is these brass chandeliers that hang down the center of the room, which until 2004, were outfitted for electricity and gas. Wow. So at some point in the night, up until the 2000s, they would dim the lights and light the gas lamps on these chandeliers. Which, I mean, I can only imagine how beautiful the room was when it was lit by lamplight. So anyway, it was an Arby's for 3 years, and the Arby's closed. The Arby's sign is still on the outside of the building, by the way. And then it became a clothing store, and then another clothing store, and then another clothing store. And then it was vacant, and it's been vacant for a year and a half.
Wow. Wow. That's great. So how do you fit into this whole equation here? Where do you come in with your partners to, you know, try to resurrect this restaurant?
Right. So I own a restaurant called Fort Defiance in Red Hook, Brooklyn. My partners, Ben and Sohi, who are old friends of mine from before we had restaurants, own the restaurant down the street from me called The Good Fork, as well as a Korean karaoke place called Insa. Fort Defiance has been open since 2009. The Good Fork's even older. And I was looking to open a cocktail bar in downtown Brooklyn, which is, you know, it's growing very fast. They're building lots of new residential towers there. And it's very centrally located. Red Hook is a neighborhood sort of off on its own. And it's a little bit difficult to get to, whereas downtown is the second densest transportation hub in the city outside of Grand Central, or Times Square. So I was looking downtown, and I brought Ben along. He knows a little bit more about construction and buildings than I do. And we looked at a place down there, and it wasn't right. And the agent said, you know, I've got something else around the corner. Let me show you. And she walked us into Gage and Toller. And we knew what it was when we were walking over there. I was like, she's not walking us into Gage Toll, is she? She walked us in. This was about 18 months ago. And we saw it, and we just instantly knew that's what we had to do, that we had to get this place back open.
That's amazing. And what kind of state was it in at that point? Is this something where you're like, this is a complete remodel, or you at least have some, obviously you have the old school structure and stuff, but what were you kind of walking into at that point?
Well, you know, the interior had always been hidden behind the false walls of the clothing retailer that was there before. And I remember walking in and seeing the chandeliers, but trying to, you know, peek behind these false walls to see what was there. When we went in, all that stuff had been removed. It was the first time that either of us had seen the space in all of its glory. And then when we went downstairs, what we found was, you know, a 21st century, you know, prep kitchen and storage area in the basement that we had not known was there and wouldn't, you know, have assumed was there. Yeah. But there's great power coming into the building. There's great gas service. There's employee washrooms. There's employee locker rooms. I mean, it's like ready to go down there. Hmm. So we said, wow, this could actually happen.
Wow. So it sounds like the TGI Fridays and Arby's experience was actually good because they might have outfitted it to today's standards and stuff and then bolted.
That's right. Yeah. We have them to thank. We have them to thank for sure.
That's the only thing I can think of because I can't think of anything else at the moment, but whatever.
Yeah.
They're not our sponsors on this. So we're all right.
That's right.
Well, that's great. How did you get into like owning restaurants and stuff? What's your background and story?
I grew up in New Jersey, went to college in New Orleans, lived there for the 90s, basically working in restaurants and bars. Moved up to New York in 99 and started to work at Bon Appetit magazine as a copywriter. Liked that, but really wanted to get back into the service industry. I really missed the sense of camaraderie among my coworkers that I had there. So, and at the time, mixology was just sort of becoming a thing in New York, like cocktail bars were just starting to open. And I went to work at the Pegu Club, which was one of the first to open on Houston Street. It's still there. It's still great. I worked there for a few years and then opened Fort Defiance, which I really always imagined as a cocktail bar in my neighborhood, but really became more of a neighborhood cafe restaurant over the years. I've always sort of loved my neighborhood. I've lived in Red Hook since 2002 and, you know, have been very, very happy to live and operate a neighborhood restaurant there. That's how I got into it.
That's cool.
But yeah, it was a time to do something, you know, to do something new, to you know, expand a little bit. And this is a little bit like, you know, Sohi, our chef said, it's like she sent us out for a carton of milk and we came home with a cow. So it's a little bit more than we thought we were going to do, but it really feels right now that we're right in the middle of it.
That's great. You know, so opening restaurants is challenging. I spent my 20 years or so in the restaurant business and helped a couple restaurants open and close here. So what makes a great restaurant? What makes a successful open? You know, what do you look for? Is it staff? Is it the chef? What are some of the most important elements to having a great new restaurant?
Oh man, you know, if I knew and I could tell you, I would probably be like the richest guy in America. It's like, it's such a tough business, and I feel like there's so much that's out of your control. You know, Ben and Sohi and I, we're survivors and we're unusual, you know. The Good Fork has been open now almost 15 years, and Fort Defiance will turn 10 next year, which is incredible. I mean, 10 years in the New York restaurant world is like a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So what makes a good place? I think that, you know, it's very hard to put your finger on, but I think that I think it's, you can tell when a place is cared for and when it's not, when there's a hand on the tiller and when there isn't. I think there's a lot of things that people do wrong at the beginning. They go in, the most common mistake, which I'm sure you've talked about, or heard about before is undercapitalization, right? Like you go in with not enough money.
Yep.
And you run out of money because your restaurant doesn't really start to swing until year two. Mm-hmm. And by then you've run through all your operating cash and you're out of business. And that's a shame. I hate to see that. It's like, it's just such a tragic thing to see. And I think the places that are able to get through the first couple years and then not slack off, keep going as keep putting as much energy into it as you can and keep, responding to your customers, being good to your staff, and putting out the highest quality product that you possibly can. I think when you do that, you stand a pretty good chance. Then the rest is out of your control. You can't really worry about the rest is, you know, what the market's doing, what the neighborhood's doing. That is not really your concern. There's things you can control and things you can't.
Yeah. So in terms of like the neighborhood you mentioned, like is there, in the Brooklyn area that you're in, is there a ton of other restaurants? Is it lots of traffic? What's sort of the environment that you're in right now? Is it students? Is it, people raising families?
Yeah.
What's kind of the environment around you?
Well, it's unusual for Brooklyn because it's very, very dense. It's in between a lot of neighborhoods that are either up and coming or have already, come up. Like it's in between a Burham Hill, Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn Heights, Fort Greene. And so those are all sort of like household names now as like cool Brooklyn neighborhoods. The downtown Brooklyn, nobody talks about because like I said, it was just sort of a commercial center and a government center, but not much more. Now there's been this growth spurt where developers in New York are taking advantage of the fact that you can build really densely in this neighborhood and are building these towers there, which, some people like, some people don't. I mean, I've been inside them. They are beautiful. Like mm-hmm. They're beautiful, beautiful places to live. They're building tons of office space. The next few years, the neighborhood will be, just packed with people and there's very few dining options. If you want to sit down and eat, if you want to grab something and go, there's lots of places that cater to all the workers in the neighborhood who work at all the government offices. Mm. But if you want to sit down and eat dinner, your choices are really very limited. So that's why we think it's a great move.
That's awesome. That's really great. Well, let's flip over a little bit to the actual WeFunder campaign. So what made you kind of stand back and say, hey, we want to, dip our hands into equity crowdfunding and what was that sort of narrative and story like amongst you and your teammates?
Yeah, this is something that we didn't expect to be doing. And it's something that's super exciting and gets more and more exciting as the campaign goes on. So we tried to raise money the old fashioned way, which is, you go to rich people hat in hand and ask for money. Mm-hmm. That didn't go great. It wasn't a complete failure, but we just, we run little restaurants in New York, not big ones. We don't rub elbows with a lot of people with a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So we found a few supporters who were really into the project, but not enough to get us even halfway to where we needed to be. We felt sort of the pressure from the landlord who had been actively showing it to other tenants. And we thought, well, this isn't working and we don't have time to meet these people. Like we have to think of something else. So he remembered a meeting that she had with somebody from WeFunder a couple years back, right when she was opening INSA, who said, the next time you open a restaurant, maybe consider, talking to us. So we did. And we thought at the time, well, we don't know, 10 people who can give us $100,000 each, but right. We probably know 1,000 people who could give us $1,000 each.
Right.
And that would get us to the same place. And something like WeFunder would allow us to do that. And that's really, it's a way, like we're much more comfortable working like that. We're comfortable working in public. We're comfortable, talking to a lot of people at the same time. We're not so comfortable in rooms with wealthy people where we have to, you know, present ourselves and then wait for their approval. We'd rather do it on a, you know, to a lot of people at once.
Sure.
And so far so good. I mean, the other thing is that I knew the support for this restaurant, this specific one, would be out there. We just needed to find it because of the reputation that the restaurant has in Brooklyn among the old timers who went there. You know, when we were over at the space, like looking at the restaurant, it fronts onto Fulton Street, which is a really busy pedestrian shopping street. And every time we were there, somebody would poke their head in and look up at the gas lamps and look around the room and say, "Oh my God, I haven't been here in 20 years. I used to come here with my grandmother," or like, "Oh, I remember I went here before my prom." Like, everyone's got stories like that. So, you know, the idea was just to get, to get the idea out in the public where people could see it and decide to come in or not. It's not even like a hard sell. It's just like, just getting the word out about the project has been enough so far.
That's awesome. Well, what were some of the kind of the concerns, or were there any concerns in terms of running an equity crowdfunding campaign like this?
Well, yeah, the big concern is that, well, you want to make sure the deal is fair. And, you know, we thought about it and sort of ran the numbers a bunch of different ways and figured out that the deal was, you know, Refunder doesn't do this for free. They take a they take a slice, but we figured out, I mean, the way that we looked at it, we thought it was reasonable. Then after that, the danger is, you know, that that no one will get on board, especially that first week. So I read Alex Daly's book, The Crowd Sorceress. Okay. I actually met with Alex before we started the campaign, and she's very it's a very good book, and it's she really puts an emphasis on getting a good press ahead of your campaign, or right when you launch, and really kind of front loading it. That was easy for us to do because in addition to running a restaurant, I write about food and drinks for different magazines, and so, you know, I talked to the writers that I know and found a writer from the Times that I really like and offered him an exclusive on the story, which they took, and they ran the story on the Friday before we started the campaign, which was on the Monday. So as far as that goes, like, you couldn't ask for anything better, because then once the story runs in the Times, then all the other sites will pick it up, and it just got us off to a great, great start. So
was there, in terms of press, was there any kickback? Again, I run a ton of Kickstarter campaigns, and a lot of press is like, we just don't touch crowdfunding campaigns anymore. Was there any feedback at all like that when it comes to equity? Because I think equity is still like the Wild West. So
yeah,
a lot of reporters are like, well, this is still kind of interesting because there's investors going on here. So what was kind of the feedback that you got on it?
Well, yeah, so that was kind of the pitch, was that it was, you know, that this was a different thing because it was an equity, a crowdfunding. And it was, you know, it's a relatively new thing and people don't understand it. So it was another thing to talk about. It's sort of another handle for writers. And when I go back and start to pitch again, now that we're kind of halfway through the campaign, I'm going to pitch it as sort of an equity crowdfunding, you know, piece to different writers, and try to hit some business publications that we didn't hit the first time around. And just to clarify too, I don't know if you know, but the raise that we're doing is actually, it's a revenue debt raise. So the investors don't get equity in the project. It's more like a loan. They're loaning us money that is repaid at a multiple of their investment. For the first, the $400,000, the investors will get 1.5 times their investment. And for the last 200,000, they'll get 1.25x.
That's cool. What was some of the decisions behind that, as opposed to maybe giving up, I don't know, 10% equity or something like that?
Well, because we were going to do this bifurcated raise, which is, again, not common. And, you know, for our lawyers, for our accountant, this is the first time that anybody had seen anything like this. So that kind of slowed us down, you know, and just putting the whole deal together was, you know, it was a bit by bit process. But so we're still doing a traditional equity raise where we're giving away 40% of the company, you know, 40 shares of the company.
Right.
And simultaneously taking a, you know, a $400,000 to $600,000 loan from WeFunder investors. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it might be interesting to note for your listeners that because we got so much press from the WeFunder raise, we then had to change the nature of the equity raise. This is getting into like a little bit of inside baseball, yeah. But we had to switch to a 506C raise, which you know, protects you. It's a, you can then only work with accredited investors with the equity raise.
Right.
That's the disadvantage. The advantage is then that you're free to advertise, which talking to the press can be seen as a form of advertising,
right,
or, you know, a seasoning the market. So, so yeah, we were, you know, in order to keep us, you know, clear of any trouble with the SEC down the line, we chose to go with the 506C raise.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, as a marketing company, that's part of my conversations I have to have with people, what we can and can't say SEC regulations on Facebook and
Twitter. Yeah, it's so vague, right? It's like, it's like the, you know, the SEC will tell you when you're doing it wrong, but by then it's too late.
Well, that's the other thing too. And that's why I had another conversation with Hops and Grain. They're a brewery out of Austin, and they were I think they're in that same boat where they had a change in the middle, and it's just because the SEC finally like kind of caught up and wrote some new rules. Because again, yep, it's the Wild West right now. So you just kind of roll with it and go, all right, I get my hand slapped, adjust, move forward, whatever, you know, whatever you got to do. So,
yeah. But I mean, for someone, you know, for us, it's great because, you know, like I said, now our customers get to participate in this in a way that, you know, if we were to do things traditionally, they wouldn't be able to. The, you know, the level of investment would be too high. Mm-hmm. But it's been great explaining to people like, no, this isn't a Kickstarter thing. This is like, you're actually investing in our next restaurant. And I know you want to do that because you come to my restaurant, you know, twice a week.
Yeah.
And for the customers, it's been great. It's been really great.
Well, you know, so one of the things, you know, that's why I think we're seeing this brewery, a lot of breweries doing this, and it makes a ton of sense. And restaurants fit in the same boat of, you know, if I'm local to you guys and I'm coming to your restaurant and I'm bringing my birthday parties, my family events, my reunions, whatever it might be, why would I not go to the place that I'm a small investor in getting a return? Like, it almost makes your you know, it's like making your street team, you know, or, you know, your own little
mini exactly
out there. And especially like for breweries where it's like, yeah, I can get a mug club for $75 or I can be an owner or a part, you know, whatever, you know, have a small stake in it. I'm going to do, you know, choice two all day, you know? So
absolutely.
It makes total sense. And I'm always intrigued as to why more and more restaurants aren't looking at this. And I think it's just, they just don't know, but man, it just seems
that's
like
it.
A great way to get, you know, eyeballs, attention, media, and your initial audience and patrons at first, you know? So it's
absolutely.
Like,
I think we're going to see it more and more. I think that with, you know, it's going to become increasingly difficult actually for restaurants to raise money through Kickstarter now, now that equity crowdfunding exists, but that's actually fine because,
yeah,
you know, when you read the perks that people are doing on Kickstarter, it's like the perks are like worth the value of the investment. It's like,
yeah,
it's like there's like a, like there's like an arms race for perks to the point where you wonder how much benefit the restaurateur is actually getting out of the deal.
Yep.
So for that reason, I think equity crowdfunding is definitely the way of the future, and I'm glad it's here.
Have you seen that most of your investors are local or at least in your region, or are you getting people from, I don't know, San Francisco investing? What does it look like a little bit behind the scenes?
Yeah, so I would say they're definitely mostly local people that plan to go to the restaurant in the future. Mm-hmm. There was one family that ran the restaurant for generations. They ran it from 1919 to the 1980s, 1987, I think. And they a few of them live in Virginia now, so they're invested, which is great.
Yeah. That's great.
And we have a few, you know, people that are WeFunder fans that just go on WeFunder and invest in things here and there. Mm-hmm. But I'd say 80 to 85% of the investment is coming from within 5 miles of the restaurant.
Wow. So outside of press, what other sort of advertising things have been doing or marketing to get the word out?
Well, we've got the website's been up for a long time now, and I'm proud of the website. I wrote most of it. There's as much information there as you could possibly want, including the full like history of the restaurant. There's old menus.
Yeah, that's cool.
There's lots of good content there. We've got an Instagram account. We're on Facebook, and we have postcards that we're handing out at our restaurants. In addition to that, we've got some things planned for the fall. Like right now is a really hard time to do business in New York or anywhere else. You know, these last weeks of August, like leading up to Labor Day. But we have some events planned for the fall. We're going to do some on-site events at the restaurant. We're going to do some more Facebook Live stuff where we develop recipes. And we're not doing any sort of traditional advertising, but we might, you know, boost a few Facebook posts here and there, boost a few Instagram posts, and, you know, see if that does anything for us.
That's awesome. So, you know, is this something that you would consider, you know, so what's intriguing about this restaurant is that you have this whole big backstory, right? Like you have all kinds of content to pull from, the old menus and all that sort of stuff. Do you think mm-hmm. that you would have the same sort of success if you had a brand new restaurant right out of the gate that didn't have this sort of, you know, backstory to it?
Well, you know, my partners and I have been in the business for a while, so we have our own, you know, our own sort of built-in audience. Mm-hmm. You know, without them, I don't know if we could do something like this, or we would have to make the goal a lot smaller.
Sure.
But it certainly does help that the restaurant has such a great story. But that's one of the reasons that we're doing it. I mean, if it wasn't for the story and the fact that we thought we could leverage it to, you know, to raise the money, I don't know if I would be doing anything like this size.
Right.
I would probably be opening the 30 seat cocktail bar in downtown Brooklyn that I had planned on opening, you know, 2 years ago.
Right.
But I mean, you know, the narrative is great, but the narrative of any place can be great. You just have to, you know, find out what it is. And as far as crowdfunding goes, like a good story, well, you know, right? That's like the whole ball game, right?
Gotta have a great story. So what happens when, you know, money starts to drop? What does sort of like the next year look like? You know, what does it look like for you and your partners?
Well, we're at $215,000 now and need to get to $400,000. That's our minimum. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you know, we have the equity raise going on simultaneously, and that should be wrapping up at the end of October. So what we're really planning to do is kind of wrap everything up at the end of October and sign a lease in the first week of November. That's sort of the goal.
Gotcha.
And then once the lease is signed, you know, then we're off to the races and we, you know, pull the permits and get to work. But that's what it looks like. I don't really want the crowdfunding raise to stretch into, you know, 2019, although it could. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to close it out at the end of October, and I think that's a very achievable goal for us.
And how much work do you see in terms of, like, you know, getting this restaurant, you know, let's go out like 2 years, you know, getting this thing off the ground? What are some of the big steps that have to happen? Is it menu, staffing? What does it all look like?
Oh my God.
It's all of it, bro.
It's all of it. It's an enormous amount of work, but the good news for us is that this has been gestating for 2 years. And so we've had lots of bad ideas about what to do with the space, or at least I have, that then I've gotten a little bit of time and distance from and been able to see how lousy they were. So the longer you kind of sit with something, the more the idea has time to fully bake. And I think we're getting close to that point now where when we sign the lease, we can start to pull the trigger on some of these things and not to, you know, wonder about, like, what do the staff uniforms look like? Well, we already answered that question. What does the menu look like? We already answered that question. So, you know, so we're figuring out things. Even now, we're talking about glassware and plates and and all that stuff. But really, I mean, the big job next year is going to be physically building the space out, and then, you know, probably hiring close to 100 people over the next, you know, 365 days. So
wow, that's great. Well, where can people dive in and learn more about just the restaurant, the story, you guys? Where can people learn more?
It's all on gageandtolner.com. That's G-A-G-E, Gage and Tolner with a T.com. It's all there, and there are links there to our WeFunder raise and lots of information about the history of the restaurant. And if you're into it, like historic menus and that sort of thing, you can have a look at the space. It's beautiful. Watch a little movie about us. And yeah, I would love it if you paid us a visit.
Awesome.
Online.
That's great. Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. I know it's probably busy for you guys, and it's a lot going on, a lot of plates spinning, no pun intended on that. But this has been a great conversation, and I definitely encourage all my listeners out there, go check out the restaurant, go check out what they're working on, go check out the WeFunder page, you know, become an investor, own a piece of a up-and-coming cool Brooklyn restaurant. So Sanjin, I thank you so much and appreciate it, man.
Brooklyn restaurant legend.
A Brooklyn restaurant legend. Yes, yes. Join into that. You know, put your stamp on that narrative. So that's awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Like I said, thanks so much for your time and good luck in the future.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Thanks. All right, that's how we do it. So I'll hit the stop button here. All right, how about that conversation? Amazing, amazing stuff there. I mean, that is a team of people who have opened restaurants. They know what's going on. They are part of the restaurant world in Brooklyn and New York there. And I wish them nothing but success. So again, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to jump on this call. To jump on our interview. It was awesome. So all right, let's pivot here. Let's listen to a Sugar People track, huh? Yeah, let's listen to this song. So this song, all the time when it gets to fall, this song, for some reason, means the most to me. It's a song called Lucky, and I think it was on the Sugar Roses collection. So again, most of you haven't heard it. And whenever I get some time to myself, and I get a little extra spending cash, I'm going to upload this track to Spotify, or this whole album to Spotify, so you guys can hear it, and it would actually make it a little easier on me because I could just port it in. But let's go ahead and listen to the song Lucky, and I hope you guys have a great rest of the day, and I will talk to you all on Thursday. We'll be right back.
You're